This week's episode is sponsored by The Collector's Agency. Are you into antiques, vintage, obscure, and unique stuff? Check out The Collector's Agency, facebook.com/The Collector's Agency, and on Instagram at Collector's Agency. Buying and selling all kinds of fun, one-of-a-kind, unique items. Shipping is available on most things. Listings are available on Etsy, eBay, and Facebook Marketplace. Please like the pages to keep up to date with all the freshest new stock that arrives. Again, facebook.com/The Collector's Agency and at Collector's Agency on Instagram. Hello, and welcome to Everything Remade, a podcast that I hope is about growth as much as it is about music. I'm Edie Quinn, and we have a great show lined up for you today. Before we get started, though, I'd like to remind you about our Patreon page at patreon.com/humanmachine, where you can go to get the latest sneak peeks of behind-the-scenes music stuff, you can read all the zines up to date, and much, much more. patreon.com/humanmachine. And now, I'd like to play something for you. You're hearing Flayed by Depiction of Man off their debut demo, Blade Demise, which features my pal Ben Krako on guitar. I've known Ben for a while, but we haven't had time to catch up in a bit, so this was real nice.
I had this general love for a lot of the heavy metal stuff of the 80s and 70s. Like, my mom was a huge Black Sabbath head and a huge Judas Priest head. We saw Judas Priest at like Milwaukee Summerfest when I was real little. And that was cool. That didn't necessarily drive me to start making music, though. Honestly, I think it probably was Fugazi.
Yeah.
The first record I ever bought was the Fugazi Seven Songs EP. And that was when I was like 14. I bought it at a Hot Topic of all places. But like, yeah, that was the one where I heard it and I went, dang, I need to, like, I'd kind of been playing guitar on and off just for the, you know, the purposes of like, yeah, I'm, you know, playing an instrument like a lot of other kids did. But that was the first one that at least drove me to be like, you can make it and you can start a band and you can kind of rock.
Okay. What was it about the guitars in Fugazi that said to you, like, you could do this?
Honestly, I think it was the especially on that EP, the guitar work is really intricate, and like, the older I get, the more I really appreciate it. But at the same time, it's kind of straightforward and driving in a way that, like, you know, I wasn't necessarily like, when I was hearing the heavy metal of the 80s, I was like, dang, I'm not a shredder. I'm not good at that, right. You know? And so like, having something that was maybe a little bit chunkier, a little bit more interesting, kind of held my ear in a way that, like, no shade to Black Sabbath, but like, that held my ear in a way for like, oh, I'm listening to a guitar that doesn't necessarily sound like anything that I've encountered so far.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember, like, you know, I'm a bit older, so like, I remember sort of like the guy from Minor Threat is in a new band thing, right? And so hearing Fugazi for the first time for me was like, it was like a culture shock or something, you know? It was like, huh? But here's the thing, is like, you know, we were playing guitar for a little bit at that time, you know, me and a couple of my friends, and we were obsessed with, like, I don't know, you know, whatever corny fat bands, or, you know, I mean, let's just like call them it's like, I don't know, they're good bands, you know, like Lagwagon or whatever, right? And
sure.
There's a lot of, like, it's fast and it's not necessarily the hardest thing in the world to play, but it's like, you're playing that, and then like, and then, you know, Fugazi comes out and you're like, oh, I didn't know that guy could play guitar. And then you're kind of like, oh, like, he's not any better than me.
Yeah, exactly. You
know? And because you're like, you know, when it or whatever the first song you hear is, and you're like, I could totally do that. So it really makes sense. And it's like, you know, it's almost just like a lesson in like, if you're creative, if you like just experiment, if you just try to think outside the box or just like work on not taking the first answer that comes to you, like you don't have to be that good to make something really awesome. And that's what I've always
absolutely
like, really appreciate. Like, I mean, you know, no, like I don't like I think it's completely fair to say that Ian McKay, like on guitar, was in not even in the same league as the rest of that band, you know, musically. Oh, yeah. You know? So like I'm not trying to like you said, you know, no shade. Like I'm not trying to be like, yeah, you suck, you know, because obviously like he was their peer in that what he did was creative enough to where he earned his place in that, not just like, oh yeah, because I do the label and I'm the cool guy, you know. But yeah, definitely a very formative band for me as well. Like it was, you know, and I mean all those Discord bands, you know, it was just like, wait, like these guitars never play the same thing as each other. That is so cool, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So you just had a guitar because it's just like, you know, a lot of times it's just like, you know, when you're, especially if your folks have been into music and it's just like, yeah, that's like, oh, having a guitar would be so cool. But it wasn't until Fugazi that you were like, eh, I should really get going on this.
I think that's true. I think that what was super weird and like kind of an interesting confluence about growing up in Northern Illinois, and like I must have started taking lessons probably when I was 10, so like 2005-ish. But slightly like the guitar teacher that I had during my like really strong punk exploration phase, because like I had friends that were into like Blink-182 and things like that, and kind of I was always curious about what was going on before that, and that's kind of how I wound up getting like, I think I bought the Fugazi record, the Minor Threat LP, and one of the Bad Brains albums all at the same time. Mm-hmm. So it was like, I was like, oh, I'm going all in on the punk thing. This is way more interesting to me. But the guitar teacher that I had at the time, I was thinking about this literally like a couple days ago, was affiliated with that, some would call them a deathcore band, others would call them a metalcore band. You could also argue like a tech death metal band, Veil of Maya from Chicago.
Oh, okay.
So it was really weird to have a guitar teacher who was like a very, you know, technical person who had been like, yeah, I played in their old death metal band type of deal. And then me being like, how do I do the Fugazi thing? And he's like, yeah, okay. But I feel like that kind of gave an interesting perspective on just the ways to approach writing in general. And also having a guitar teacher that was maybe, you know, I'll be honest, I haven't listened to like a Veil of My LP in a long time, but like, having a someone who at least was like less interested in blues rock and standards was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's that was really the first driver to like, I have to do something that's not playing pentatonic riffs and, you know, grinding my scales or whatever.
Yeah. So is that what you were before you discovered, you know, this like little holy trinity of, you know, albums, is that what you were doing before? They were just like,
yeah, it was basically that. I mean, like I grew up playing violin a little bit and then switched to guitar at some point because I thought it just looked like, you know, I was clearly getting into rock and I was like, well, there's more utility probably to playing the guitar than playing the violin long term, even if that's not necessarily true.
Yeah, it's weird because like, you know, the thing is like we have seen that violin does work really well with like, you know, screamo or even crust or, you know, that this generally heavy music. But like at the same time, you know, yeah, you can't be the violin player necessarily that like starts the band.
Oh yeah, no, yeah. It's not happening. Especially with like what most people come in with, it's just like, you know, if you were a little bit more creative, no one is typically that creative at 14 to think like, maybe I should throw a violin on this. It's usually the guitar is what's there. It's guitar, it's bass, it's drums, just the standards. And it's like, yeah, you're not going to be necessarily like, because also I feel like it's the same. It's kind of got a similar thing where it's like, there's not a ton of violin teachers out there who have not necessarily the ability or the interest, but it maybe the cultural context for pushing you into directions that might be a little bit more challenging, especially when you're like teaching 15, 10 year olds, you know?
Yeah. I can't imagine being like going to your violin teacher and being like, yeah, check out this band called like Fall of Ephrafa. I want to like learn how to play stuff that would be cool on this, you know? Like, my wife was taking violin lessons a few years ago, and she was like, she was taking them from like a like 70-year-old retired lady, you know? So like, I'm just imagining this like every time, like somebody just like rolling in with like, you know, we came out like tigers or something, putting on like, do you have a turntable somewhere so I can put this? Oh, forget it. We'll listen to the MP3s. It's fine. You know? But, yeah, I mean, it's one of those things too, where it's like, if you were in that band and you were like trying to find a violin player, like you never will, you know? 'Cause like A Camille, we had two violin players over, you know, the course of a couple years. And like, it was like, I felt like we were just in the right place at the right time. 'Cause like when it was time to go from like one to the next, it was like impossible until just like somebody fell in our lap. You know, it's like,
I have always wondered about this. Were they like proper violin players, or were they musicians who happened to play the violin on the side?
Okay. So like our first violin player, Amanda, she was like, someone who played when she was younger and then didn't really play but still had one. And like, you know, I don't mean to diminish what she did, because I think it was cool, and it was like, it was a lot to ask somebody, and she like was always like stoked and like was a, just like, you know, such a, she was such a like a awesome like wing person for the band, you know, as far as just like, but like our second violin player, Mel, she was like literally the year before like winning state competitions and stuff.
Whoa.
So it's kind of night and day from our demo to like our, what was supposed to be our 7-inch, you know, like, just like the way that, and also like, you know, Mel, like Amanda was more or less like, show me what you think I should play in notes, you know? And I'm like, well, so we're transcribing like guitar, like root notes to violin. Gotcha. But Mel was like, I said, like she was like gold ribbon winner, like at state, you know, championships and stuff. So she's just like, oh, you're in this key. And then she's like, and I'm like, yes, that's the thing that you're supposed to do. Cool. Goodbye. You know, like you do your thing and don't worry about me. So it was really night and day as far as that goes. And that's the funny thing about like, you know, social media too, is like now it's like I still chat with Mel, but it's like Mel doesn't have her own Instagram. Like she has an Instagram for her dog. So like I'm
so like dog.
I get a message from like, you know, this dog's Instagram, and it's like, I'm at a conference in Purdue, you know? And I'm like, awesome. But I mean, that's social media, right? It's like, it's so random sometimes, but yeah, you know, Mel, if you're listening, I love you. Anyway, yeah, it's funny how, you know, like I also played violin when I was little, and you know, just a brief funny story. There's one violin on a Coma Regalia song on our second album. And I had my daughter play it. And she was about 10 at the time. And it's funny because, like, I just had her do a bunch of takes because she's 10. You know, she wasn't great, but it was important to me for her to do it. And she wanted to do it, right? So, like, I just had her do a bunch of takes, and I cut them together. Like, this is how things work, right? And she heard it, and she was like, "You redid them, didn't you?" And I was like, "I absolutely did not, Dave Grohl, you know, no, I did not." And I explained to her, I was like, you played it lots of different times, and then what I did is I just pieced the different times together so that it presents the best version of what you did, you know. And she's like, "Oh yeah, that's cool." Like, I literally showed her, like, this is the patches and this is how this worked, you know. But it was funny because, like, you know, when I was trying to show her how to do it, I did pick the violin back up, and I was like more competent than I remembered. Do you feel like you could pick a violin up at this point, or is it like new?
That's a tough one. Yeah, that's a good question. I don't think I had I was always really bad at the actual positioning of it. Bowing was fine, but, like, I remember I still have bad posture. So, like, it was always a, you know, tap it on your back, like, "Oops, this is sit up." But I don't know. That's a good question. We do have a cello around here somewhere. No, not a cello, a viola, the second smallest one.
Yeah.
I should pull it out and find out.
Yeah, figure it out at some point. Yeah, it's fun. I think that it's a lot of fun to just, like, sort of pick up a random thing and see how well it works. But yeah, which is, like, you know, the last, like, I don't even, you know, in your new thing, Depiction of Man, like, I don't even know, what are you doing in that?
I'm doing guitar. I'm the okay. Kind of chunkier, lower end guitar, the one that kind of just sounds like Unbroken.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, because, like, I, you know, it's just, like, the demo, and I'm not sure how y'all recorded that or whatever, but it's, like, you know, obviously, like, the songs sound really cool, and it's a very serviceable demo, but, like, y'all did the mysterious thing where it's not really, like, there's not credits, you know, or anything necessarily. So I was like, yeah, I don't know, maybe, you know, Ben's the vocalist, maybe, like, I don't, you know, I don't hear any synthesizer in this necessarily, so.
No, that was a purposeful choice. I think I'm good on the synthesizer for a minute. But yeah, I mean, it's not like I'm fine with, you know, sharing what everybody did. Yeah, we recorded it live. It was we had a little bit of some timing issues with getting into, like, a more formal studio, right? And we just wanted something out because it's the first project that basically everyone in the band has done for now a couple of years. So we just wanted something out to say, like, "Yo, this is what we've been working on. We think these songs are pretty solid." And so it was just, like, two room mics, and our vocalist Mel actually recorded and mixed it.
Okay. And you have been, like, this has been going for, like, quite some time, and it's just, you know, been hard to get everything together and put something out there.
Yeah, we had a couple. So Seb, the drummer, used to be in a band called Valtiel out here in Seattle.
Oh yeah, I'm familiar with them.
Yeah, they rock. But me and him had been kind of getting together since probably November of 2022-ish. And I had a couple riffs, and we were kind of expanding that. And there was a lot of, like, stop and start just based on timing at the time that Seb was in a couple other projects and couldn't necessarily have a bunch of, or didn't have a bunch of time to dedicate to Depiction at the moment. And then actually fleshing out the lineup took a lot of time. We had a couple folks that kind of rotated in and out, and then on Seb's suggestion, Jeff, also from Valtiel, the guitarist of Valtiel, came on because he hadn't been playing much. And then Jeff had the suggestion of Kane, who is someone that he grew up with out in Tacoma area, playing bass. Kane was in a couple of gent bands. I don't know if he wants me to say, but shout out to Illuminator. I'm going to do it. And then Mel is actually relatively new to Seattle. Is they've lived up here for I think only a couple of years, but we knew them through the sort of DIY all ages venue and community space out here, the Vera Project.
Okay, and is this like, is this everybody, like, except for, you know, the folks in Valtiel, is this everybody's sort of like first band in a while, or is it?
I think it's everyone's first band in a while. It's definitely my first like real band in a while. I've done a few like solo noisy type stuff, but yeah, it's basically everyone's first real band in a minute.
Yeah. And, you know, we were talking before, like, you know, you and I haven't like chatted or anything in, you know, nearly 7 years or something. But how did you end up out there in Seattle? Was it like career, you know, job stuff or?
Like a little bit of column A, a little bit of column B being I grew up in Illinois. I like within always about 20 miles of Chicago my entire life. When COVID hit, I kind of wanted a change, and it had been something that my partner and I had been talking about for a minute. We kind of went through the options, and we had the only city we really agreed on was Seattle, but I really wanted to get outdoors a little bit more. And also just in general for what both of us do, they do art. They did the art for the demo. And for what I do, which is, I have a math degree, so I'm more of a tech loser, but, yeah, it's just it's a slightly better city, I think, for some of those options. So we wound up here in the fall of 2020. We kind of made a bold decision, rented a U-Haul, and just did it.
Wow. How much did you have lined up out there? Like jobs or just like...
I actually wound up...
I was working somewhere.
I was working remotely for my company in Chicago when I moved out to Seattle, and then... I wound up getting a job here not too long after, just because I was tired of waking up at 6 in the morning to start.
Right.
Because I was working on
Chicago
time.
Even
then it was early. Yeah. But yeah, it was actually the worst part was finding an apartment out here, because we had to do a lot of like, landlord shows you, like a FaceTimes you and shows you a video of the blurriest apartment you've ever seen. You have to be like, yeah, I think that looks good. Hopefully you don't scam me.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't imagine, especially with everything that's going on. That must've been like, yeah, it's a leap of faith, you know, but I'm glad it worked out. The last, you know, time that we hung out or whatever had to have been one of the Gas Up shows where I was doing vocals. I was thinking, it's really wild. Like for that last year or whatever that Gas Up was a band, like I played more shows than Kyle did.
Oh yeah, I know. And, it's always really funny to think about.
And like, I don't know. I was wondering, like, how many out of all the songs and stuff that, you know, like we were playing and whatever, how many Gas Up songs did you end up like actually recording?
Not a lot. It was so,
cause we were playing shows for like 2 years.
Yeah.
And I was just like, there's the split 7-inch that y'all did. And then there's like a couple other things that just like randomly, but yeah.
We had, so the, I guess it was, if you really want to count it, which is crazy to think, but like it's at 4 tracks, despite being in the band for, I think, 3 or 4 years. Towards the end, we had a lot of things written and some things recorded that just never came out. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it wound up only being 4 tracks. It was the split with Iwakura, and then one thing that came out as part of a compilation that was supposed to be on a later 7-inch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just was thinking about that, because I'm like, you know, like there was the whole thing where like there's a bunch of photos that like were from the shows that I played with y'all, and like there was some that I had seen the originals of and I was in them, and then when they would get posted to the Gas Up shows, socials or whatever, I would not be in them. And I was like, that doesn't feel good. I was just like, yeah, we like, you know, I played a lot of shows and you played a like you know, twice as many or three times as many as me, you know, in that 3 years, including the tours and stuff. And it's just like, A Camille was like kind of the same way. You know, we were talking about A Camille earlier. A Camille was a band for like 3 years and we had like literally like 9 songs or something, you know? And that was, you know, that was a different story. It's just wild to think about, like there was a lot of, you know, boots on the ground, a lot of, you know, stuff happening, a lot of work being done or whatever you want to look at it. And then it's like, when you think back, you're like, what really even happened? Like, what are we?
Yeah, we worked really hard with nothing to show for it, to be honest. Right, it's, it actually, like, I really value my time in GASUP. I think it was very fun. I think I was perhaps a little bit naive and immature. I think I joined when I was 19 and it ended when I was like 22. And you know, it was a time in my life that I look back on really, really fondly, but also with some hesitation and some sort of, you know, like I don't regret it, but like there are aspects of it I absolutely regret. Like writing was always like pulling teeth. Even scheduling tours and stuff wound up being like pulling teeth in a lot of cases. Like the amount of things that we had scheduled that we just had to bail on and burned so many bridges in a really negative way. Yeah. It made me not want to play music in a band context until the pandemic started, honestly. Like if we dissolved in 2017-ish, it was like, I tried to do a couple things with like Dylan and David, but they just didn't stick. And then I found myself like completely uninterested. And like, I didn't pick up a guitar and I didn't pick up a synthesizer for 2 years, probably.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Is that like part of, you know, what you said earlier where you're like, I think I'm good on the synth for now?
Yeah, I mean, it's more, I really liked the music that we were making and I really liked the general direction it was going in, but I wasn't a trained synth player. I kind of lucked into it, to be honest. And I still have all the synths. Like I'm looking at one right now, but like, I think in a band context, it's just not something I'm as interested in making at the moment. Maybe it'll the pendulum can always swing the other direction, but, yeah, it's just not necessarily what I'm interested in at the moment. Yeah,
for sure. I mean, it's one of those things where it's always, If you already have one, because otherwise it's like a little bit cost prohibitive, but it's like, yeah, one of those things where it's like really handy to have something around, because you never, like, there's always going to be, if you're doing a longer thing and you're like, an interlude would be really cool right here.
Exactly.
Sure, be great if somebody had some synths laying, you know, or like, yeah. So, but it is definitely like, just like we were talking about with violin, like, I mean, the the synth player that could form a band around their synth stuff in screamo or whatever is few and far between, you know. Not saying it couldn't happen, it probably does happen more than I'm thinking of at the moment, you know. But like, unless you're doing like, you know, like a chip tuney kind of, you know, like it's just not, that's not the thing. It's usually like the guitars and then the synth is additive, you know.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I mean, only like, I don't know when it'll come back around, but I do feel like whenever the Locust gets trendy again will probably be the next dawn of these sorts of things happening and bands being formed directly around the synth in a way that is more than just one or two at a time.
Yeah. 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 I mean, it's wild to think like how many, bands Justin Pearson has been in like that, like have sort of directly influenced like a, like have pointed the way for a musical style, you know, like I feel like there's, I feel like even, you know, like the last couple of bands that he's done, like when you start like hearing Def Club or whatever, and then bands that are more similar to that start like cropping up and you're like he's still doing it, you know.
He plays here like in the last maybe 8 months. It'll be like, because my partner also works at the Fair Project, which is how we've had the general like ability to meet people on a pretty quick scale. Which he's played there like with various configurations and various bands. He's played there like 3 times in the last months, and we always find out like the day of, we're like, oh yeah, I guess it's another Justin Pearson band. But you're right, it's like, it is crazy. Like, you know, Swing Kids spawns basically an entire sound and style, and then the Locust spawns an entire sound and style, and I would even argue that Retox to a certain extent spawns an interest in very aggressive 80s informed hardcore, probably amongst a group of people that wouldn't be naturally gravitating towards that. Yeah. It's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's wild. Absolutely. Like absolutely mind boggling discography. I don't, if I ever chatted with Justin for the show, I'd spend like 5 days listening to stuff that I never heard of, even, you know. But
the elusive 9-hour episode.
Yeah. I'm just like, but I don't have to worry about that. Justin Pearson did play in my basement once, but like, I'm sure he does not remember who I am. At any rate, you said that you'd been working on the songs that you did release for a while. Was that sort of like recording, was that more or less like, we're gonna do these because we know these the best? Like, was it just like, what was the, you said you were trying to get into some studios and it just, you know, a lot of crossed wires, so was it just like, let's get something out, like you said, just to, so we can show people what we've been working on, and then there's plans to like, you know, do like a proper studio with like more songs? Like, what's the,
yep,
you know? Yeah,
100%. It's the, with the five, I call them 4.5, I guess, that we did were just ones that we were familiar with, ones that we felt like were a good smattering of things, but we have 11 or 12, so we're cranking them out in at a rate that I don't think I've ever cranked out stuff. It's a really easy group to write with. Yeah, it was just a scheduling thing for the, we wanted to have a demo out just to start playing some shows and to start booking some longer runs. And you know, it suffices for that, but you know, we do want to get in with a particular studio engineer who's done a lot of the work for like bands like Gag and Apex Predator out here. The kind of hardcore end of things that we generally love working with. So, he was just very, very busy at the time in which we were like, okay, we got to put something out, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So is that, are you planning on splitting these songs up, or are you like, okay, fuck it, like LP?
Dude, I kind of want to do an LP. Yeah. I've never been in a band that's actually done one. Like I've only been in like, you know, high school hardcore power violence stuff, which was always like at its height was a slightly long EP. My first real screamo band was only EPs and tapes, and then Gossip was you know, had the grandiose plans to do an LP maybe, but no, I kind of want to do an LP, but also it's, you know, I think that there's something nice about having a lot of things in front of you that you can just kind of knock through and that you're really tight on, so that that way you, if you do have the reason to split them off, it's nice to always have a little bit of something. I forget who or like which podcast I was listening to, but something I found interesting, it was an interview with the guy from Military Gun. And he said that he had recorded like the LP and 3 7-inches like right at the start, and that he was just splitting them off in different ways. And I sort of want to model this in a similar way, if I can.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, from like the outside looking in, it's kind of like, to me, there's nothing more badass than when a band just like drops an LP as their very first thing. You know, it's very cocky in a way. And I respect that, especially if the band, like if the LP is solid where it can back it up, you know? But like, yeah, there's a known, like there's a proven sort of like history of like, well, you put out a couple smaller things for people to just sample, you know, as it were, and then it's like, oh yeah, like I really like doing an LP straight out of the bat. It feels in a way like a risk or an investment, you know. And so yeah, certainly doing like recording enough stuff for all of it and then just like sort of being able to parse it out as you like and when you like would be fantastic. I sort of do that with my zines, you know, like I'm working on lots of them at the same time, and I'm just like, you know, oh, okay, like now this one's out, and it looks like I just finished one and then drew an entire other one in like a week, but I didn't, you know, like, it's just the way like to like, you know, like keep thing, like I like to keep working on something, and I also like to keep things coming out as opposed to, cause a lot of times it's just like feast or famine, right? It's like, especially if you have collaborators, it's like, you're waiting on these persons for this. You're waiting on these people for this. And then no matter how you set your deadlines or whatever, like some people are early, some people miss them. And then you set these deadlines like 3 months apart and you get everything at the same time. You're like, what is this? you know, when you've done all of it and then you can just decide, oh, okay, I'll just do this. Like that's definitely, you know, that's a smart move in a lot of instances. While we were talking about zines, like I didn't even know that, until we started chatting again, that was a thing that you were into and you were doing. I, you know, just based on like the, title in your profile, I did a little digging and I found out like I'm probably going to say it wrong. The Gailcat Press.
Ah, close enough.
Yeah. And so you have a collaborator there and you've released like a really beautiful, like, excuse me if this is the wrong word, but like an art house, you know, sort of boutique zine that comes with a cassette. Tell me how you started working with your collaborator and what that process has been like.
Oh, that's my partner. That's Yewon Kwan.
Okay.
Yeah. We've been together for a long time. They've actually always really been into the zine community. They have been screen printing and risograph printing for a long time, and they were kind of we had met a few months after Gossip had kind of dissolved, and I was kind of honestly feeling like maybe a little bit lost on creative stuff. And so after dating for a year or two, it was like, well, this seems fun. I like going to these events and reading the zines that you have. It kind of like, I had come from the zine world in like a, or approached the zine world before in a very like classic punk zine way of like, yeah, here's a bunch of articles, here's a bunch of interviews, you know, the sort of model for a long time. But like the comic scene as a whole was kind of a mystery to me, and it was cool to get a little bit more engaged in understand that world a little bit more. And I just thought I would make one, and I found a lot of joy in it. And then, you know, we've kind of continued working together in various capacities. They're much more of they're an insane, their output is insane. I like doing one every once in a while.
Yeah. Well, I didn't, but yeah. I didn't see, an Instagram for the, Galecat. Does your partner have one that people could check out?
Yeah, it's, it is. Let me verify it. It's changed once. It is a Yay Station 4, YAY, and then station, and then the number 4, okay. like PlayStation 4.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah. Because, yeah, like I said, I mean, the what I was able to check out online, like, it looked awesome. What was your role in that?
On that side, I actually did the music on that. And okay. Then also, we had worked on, like, the story together. They're a much better drawer than I am, so it's... And a better visual artist for sure. So it was, it was kind of a natural split in that way. We're planning on one for the Seattle Art Book Fair in about a month to kind of flip that on its head a little bit. But yeah, and then we kind of worked together on the concept and a lot of the sort of assembly process. We definitely did together. That one was fun and also very annoying.
Yeah, that's crucial to have someone help assemble if you can, because that's the part that it's like, you said annoying, and I mean, I was gonna be kinder about that, but it's like, yeah, when you're in a band or whatever, and you're like we made that new album that fucking rules, like, and you listen to your album and you're like, yes, this fucking rules, and then like you're just like cutting out like pieces of paper and stapling them and doing all this other shit for like three entire fucking days, you know. Oh, and you're like you're like,
Yewon put out as a book, they do a sort of big anthology series called Pallor Pink, usually once a year, and they we did one that was like they did one that was 80 some pages long. Oof. And had to get perfect bound, but we had to collate it ourselves. That took hours, and if like you have 40 pages or whatever that's in a big line, and you have to remember exactly where you were. You can't, like, there's no way to get into, you can get into a trance, but getting into a trance kind of is a disservice to you and the work, because one of them is going to wind up upside down, and then you're going to have to figure it out. But yeah the physical process of bookmaking is something that has been absolutely fascinating to learn about. And I feel like musicians often get a little bit of a luxury on not having to do maybe something, you know, you lift your 8x12 into your basement, but like you don't have there's not this very annoying, like, a lot of musicians aren't as involved in
the
logistics of production as much as maybe visual
you
artists
get the
are.
Masters and you maybe do the art a lot of times. Somebody just hires somebody to do the art, and then like you get the record to your house and it's got the thing, the lyric slip already in it, and it's got the record inside the sleeve, you know, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you're good. And obviously some people do some other different things, like, you know, No Funeral, like, is very inventive in what they do, you know, as far as like they will have like the whole, like, they did one recently which was like, it was a manila envelope and like some like X-ray looking things in it. So it looked like a medical file, you know?
Oh,
so,
that's fun.
So it does exist that, you know, people do this other thing, but you know, what we're talking about is like, yeah, for sure. A lot of bands like basically more or less receiving final product, like in the mail. And, I do have a couple records that are like that for, you know, Coma Regalia or whatever, just as circumstances worked out. But it's like, the other thing is something else. Like, I think my longest, no, I mean, I don't think I know it. My longest zine is 64 pages, and and the cover is screen printed, and it's like, yeah, this is just stuff that you don't think about, like, until you're doing it, right? Because, like, I'm putting the 64 pages together, and that's like, you know, you're divide that by four, because, you know, that's how many actual sheets of paper you got. So you got 16 sheets of paper plus the cover, so 17 actual sheets of paper getting, like, collated. Then you go to your paper cutter, and you're like, this isn't going to cut that. Like, so you have to figure out, you're like, how many sheets of paper can my paper cutter cut at once? So you're basically taking it into three chunks. You're like, okay, here's, like, you're folded in half, and then you're like, here's five pages, here's five pages, here's five pages. And you, like, you were saying, you can't just, like, zone out, because you have to remember, like, hey, which of these is the outside, which is the inside, you know what I'm saying? And then, like, and then you're just, like, with all your might, like, stapling this through these 16. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, that's the thing where you're like, I know that people are looking at this, like, why does this cost $10, you know, or whatever, like, outside of the zine world? Because in the zine world, you're like, no, it's because you spend a lot of time working on that, you know? But it's like, yeah, I know that sometimes people are looking at this like, why does this cost $10? It's like photocopies or whatever, you know? And you're like, you have no idea.
Like, yeah, exactly.
No idea. But yeah, really, really fun stuff. It said that you did a showing, like a performance that was involved in this.
Yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, that was at the, it wasn't sanctioned by them, but we did get the opportunity to perform at the Pitchfork Music Festival at a book tent that it's my biggest claim to fame, you know. I played all over the country with Gas Up, and I'm really proud of that. But, like, I think it rocks to play behind Haim, like physically behind Haim, while they were headlining Pitchfork Fest, while we read a comic and made noises.
That's wild.
Yeah, it's a really strange thing to think about, but it was very, very, I mean, you can imagine that there were 30,000 people there to see Haim or whatever, and then about five or six to see us. So it was you know, it's just a funny thing. Yeah, there was a one-off performance for that. I think performing more of them, though, would be, or, like, performing more often with that would be kind of fascinating. There's an excellent, like, comics performance series in Chicago called Zine Not Dead, where they would grab six readers or whatever, and they would often perform their comics in a way that was very, very outstandingly creative. Like, I had a friend that did, there was a full dating simulator where they had, like, they had built an interactive airplane dating simulator, and they were kind of just playing it up there. There's been some other ones where I didn't actually get to go this one, but my partner always thinks of this one fondly, where it's it was a tattoo artist predominantly, and he basically put a bunch of audience drawings into a hat and then had it tattooed on him while he read his comic. Just a very, very kind of pushing the boundaries on what the performance of a comic can be. And if you're in Chicago, check it out, because it is really fun.
Yeah, that's awesome. I wish that I could ever get into and out of Chicago in the time that it should take you. You know, because I would go to Chicago.
It's so far for you. Yeah. It's like, and it shouldn't be far for you, no. But it is weirdly really far.
Yeah. You're like you just, like, you're like, yeah. I mean, back in the day, like, I had made it to Chicago, like, in an hour and a half out of hour 45 minutes. Like, I did that more than a couple times back in the day, you know, just going to shows at Fireside or whatever. Mm-hmm. But Now if I go to Chicago, it's like 3-4 hours. You know, and it's just like, why is this like this? I mean, I can get back in 2 hours because it's like no traffic, you know? Or if there is traffic, it's everybody's driving 80 and a 55, you know, because it's like 2 in the morning, you know. But I mean, the last time that I spent any extensive amount of time in Chicago, you know, I was there with Nate, and we went down to one of the comic shops, and there was a event coming up in like 2 weeks that was like fucking Jeff Lemire and Tilly Walden both on the same day, and I was like, oh, like why does Chicago have to be so difficult to like traverse sometimes? Because I mean, I like Jeff Lemire a lot, but like, let me tell you, like Tilly Walden, like she's out there saving lives. Like, I guarantee you, like there's so many queer kids that read On a Sunbeam that are just like, they're just like, okay, I'm good. This is going to be all right. You know, like if I would have read that when I was a kid, like, I mean, it blew my mind when I did read it. Don't get me wrong. But like, if I would have read that when I was a kid, like I wouldn't, none of the shit that I had to figure out in my like 20s and 30s, like it wouldn't have taken me that long. I would have figured some shit out. But, you know, so yeah, it's wild. You know, Chicago, why is it so hard to love you? You know?
Yeah. It's, growing up there, it's like, it took moving out here to realize that like a lot of, you know, things that I was just like accepting is like, it's just how it is. It's like, oh, it can be different in other places. And you don't realize it until you spend some time away.
Yeah. So you, like, it seems like there's like a, you know, I haven't spent a ton of time in Seattle. I've been there twice, but I really only like, sort of went out and walked around, and you know, it was the quintessential like shitty, cold Seattle, rainy, like, but we had fun, you know, we had some fun. We like saw some record stores where I bought like I got like 20 CDs for like $15. Yeah. You know, you know, it was very cool, but like it seems like, you know, there's a very vibrant sort of like art community and like music community there that you've sort of found yourself a part of.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it is a tough city, and not in like a Rust Belt tough way. Anyone who tells you that is lying. But it's a very expensive place to live. And that is probably its biggest attraction for me. But at the same time, it does mean that there's something kind of interesting in the sense that like the people who do choose to remain here as opposed to moving to Tacoma or Portland kind of create at a level that is almost because they have to and not because they necessarily want to. And there's something that kind of gives it a strong authenticity. At the same time, on the flip side, like I can acknowledge that the negative is that some, especially the younger folks, like, It is a city that skews a hair older than some other ones that I've like played in and been in, just because it is so expensive to live here that it's like very difficult, unless you're a University of Washington student, to maybe justify living here. And that I totally understand why like more kids who are 18 and moving out and want to be in a punk band are going up to Bellingham or going down to Portland or Tacoma.
Yeah. Yeah. It just doesn't make as much sense. But yeah, I guess I can see how, like, you know, when you gotta pay those Seattle bills, like you gotta have your head in the game. You gotta have an edge almost, and really be pushing like the most you can do, like with art or whatever, to justify it all. But so like, you know, we've sort of circled back to Depiction of Man a couple times, and you know, it sounds like the next, you know, thing is that, you know, you're going to hook up with the engineer that you want to hook up with, and then, you know, we'll see either an LP or an LP and a couple other things, you know, but but we'll get to that. But like, you also said that the demo was because you're trying to book shows and stuff. Like, do you have some shows coming up that that you're excited about? Or
yeah, we've got a couple things coming up, probably starting in July. The one thing that is kind of funny about being a little bit older and playing in bands is that folks are just a little bit busier, so it's a little bit harder to get stuff going. But we're also planning for a October, November-ish fall time West Coast tour.
Okay.
So that's kind of the next couple things. So a couple local gigs in the Seattle area. Okay. That I unfortunately can't announce yet at this very moment. But
gotcha.
Yeah, keep an eye out in summer and fall.
Yeah, where that's was going to be my next thing, because like I don't like was there an Instagram page for the band? I don't remember if I
So I created one the other day, and it's not super active yet, but by the time that this comes out, you can follow us at Depiction of Man on Instagram. It's all one word.
Okay. So that'll be the place to go to, you know, find
out. Yeah, I would say
the
so. We kind of wanted to do a thing where we didn't have an internet presence, but we just like we did the math on it and it doesn't make much sense.
Yeah. It's I think we're past the point where you don't need to have all of them, right?
No, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like it really felt like for a while it was like felt like you should have all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Because people were really like some people were really about this, some people were really about that. And now it's like, look, you just need one place where you can point people and say, hey, if you want to know, like, not everybody loves Instagram or whatever, but if you want to know where the shows are, like, hit up the Instagram. So yeah,
yeah. And also, it feels like the choice has been made for you in a lot of ways. Like, it doesn't necessarily, like, Facebook seems like a minefield at this point, and same with Twitter to a certain extent.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I don't know. It's wild. I think, like, it's been really weird, like, to watch over the last, like, year or two, how there have been all these opportunities for another platform to sort of come in and be the centralized, like, whatever replacement for any one of these other things. And it just hasn't happened for various reasons, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's also weird to watch, like, how these different, like, these different platforms attract a very specific, like, demographic or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, like it's weird. Like, because I don't use Threads. Like I signed up for it cause I know what it was. And, then of course you can't unsign up for it apparently, or you'll lose like whatever. But anyway, so I don't use it. Right. But they try to show you the stuff all the time. And it was like for a long time, it was like Israeli propaganda.
I was gonna say all Zionist content, and I can't it's just constant, and it's like you think you're like this, and I'm like, why the fuck would you think I would like?
Why do you think? And it's like I know why you're showing me that, and it's because you know I don't like it. Like you know I don't. And. And then it's like, but then in the last like 6 months, and I'm not doing anything differently, right? Mm-hmm. But it's just like in the last 6 months, all I see is like, do you think this, like, and it's just like the little thumbnail where it's like, they're trying to get you to click that. And then all I see is, do you think this skirt is too short for a 40-year-old? And I'm like, oh my God, like what happened, you know? And like, just from the various other, like, there's Blue Sky or whatever. And I like, I ended up on there, and it's like all art people. That's like all the art people from Twitter. And you're like, okay. And then there was Hive for a minute. And that was like all like horny trans people. At least that's what I was seeing. And it's like, it's just wild how like all of these, not everybody ever just went to one thing. It was like everybody just like sort of breaking off and going into the, you know, and just like these demographics, like having like their way with this platform or that platform. And then of course we all know Twitter just went to like, just like right wing, you know, MAGATs or whatever you want to call them. And it's just, I don't know. It's wild, but,
It's like, it almost feels like I've actually, like, this has been something I've been thinking about. I do think like there's probably the room for a rich, like, it's so strange to say, but I feel like I was young enough in going to like hardcore and punk shows in Chicago that like I kind of missed out. I like came in right on the tail end of like some of the message board days, but it almost feels like we're probably heading back towards that, or a more robust zine and physical stuff culture. Like, I joke about it with my partner, but like I keep a stack of flyers next to me so that I know what's going on without having to go a bunch of different places. And I call it the hardcore news. Like, it's where I'm like, I'm going to read the news. Oh, what's going on this weekend?
All right. Let's see here. You know, you got your coffee there, you know, you break out this stack of papers.
First thing, 8 a.m, I'm reading the hardcore news to see what's going on.
That's awesome. Yeah. It's, you know, I do feel like people are saying that is happening. And like, obviously, like, as someone who loves to create like little, you know, mementos and physical objects, I'm all for that. I've seen a lot of people say also, like, I've seen people, I saw someone complaining the other day online. Someone was like, I was at LDBBB Fest, or if I got that wrong, then excuse me. But somebody was like, you can tell that the kids these days are more about merch than they are about bands. And I'm like, please come to my shows. Because, like, that's what I do. I make stuff. And, like, who is complaining about this? Like, it's definitely, like, you know, where there's like Substacks and stuff, where it's like more of a newsletter. I feel like there's something happening there where it's just like, like, obviously people still do it. I mean, heck, I still do it, you know, even browsing on an app or whatever, but it's like, we're all sort of like tired of it, you know, in a way.
So, yeah. No one's happy with it. And it harkens the question of like, having to accept something that you're not happy with just in the interest of like, that's where things are happening. Or if it's like, I guess it's tough when the motivation to create something new, especially to serve these things up, is just, I just think it's hard to get that motivation when there's not, it feels like the financial circumstance in at least the US is what I can mostly speak for, is just so different, and the general class struggle is just so different at the moment that it just it's really hard to get the motivation for somebody to create something altruistic, even if that's maybe the wrong word for it, but to create something without a profit motive, just on the interest of like, hey, this is for the 200 people that live in this between Seattle and Tacoma to know about like gigs, you know?
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, we did cover, like, you know, as far as people finding out what y'all are up to, that's, you know, Instagram will be Depiction of Man, but and then, you know, they can check out your partner's work, including the work that you've done with them on the zine at Yay Station 4. But as far as, like, you said that you're working with your partner on something, like, at the moment, is that something that you can talk about a little bit more to sort of allude to?
Yeah, it's another sort of issue of the Gelcat thing. It's going to be a collaborative sort of half zine, half music thing, kind of an abstract sort of thing. And it should be out at the Seattle Art Book Fair, which is, if you're in Seattle, come by. I don't know what table we are. I don't think we've gotten that info yet, but it'll be the first weekend of May.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. And there's also, usually we also are in Chicago a few times a year just because it's where we see a lot of our friends. So we'll probably be at the Chicago Alternative Comics Expo and possibly one other fair that I'm forgetting the name of.
Awesome. If y'all hit up Chicago at some point, you should check out this art like installation space that they've got going in Lafayette. See if you could work out a stop into Lafayette to show something.
I've been wanting to come back to Lafayette for a while. I've actually been wanting to come back to Indiana for a while. Every time I try to visit my parents, I usually actually fly into a different like adjacent state, and then I just rent a car and drive in because I realized that like one of the best parts of playing with Gossip was getting to play in a lot of weird small Midwestern towns. And
yeah, just not that one in Kentucky. That's all.
Oh my gosh. I still, when anyone asks me what the worst thing I've ever, like the worst show I've ever played was, I have an instant answer. It's always that instant one.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Hit me up on the side if you want to hear about that. I'm fine with that.
Like, I think I've actually sort of told that story on the show before.
No way. We can figure it out. I'll just listen to all of them and then find out. Yeah, that was something else. And the worst part was driving 15 hours for it.
It was something.
But it's like recently, like when I went back for the holidays in December, I actually stopped in St. Louis first just to be like, oh, I'm gonna explore this part of Missouri, like in some of the, like the towns around St. Louis and stuff like that. So I have been wanting to make it, all that to be said, I have been wanting to make it back to Lafayette for a while. And also I'm going to do a plug really quick for Depiction of Man. The one thing that we all agree on in terms of playing stuff is that we love playing weird small towns. Maybe not weird, weird's the wrong word, but we love playing your very small and kind of out of the way places that don't otherwise get traffic. So genuinely, like, hit us up. I kind of want to do a Google Sheet or a Google Form to basically just collect information on like who books in XYZ middle of the country, strange place, because we'll come and play it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I've said a number of times on the show, it's just like some of those places where you don't get like Ostraka every time they tour, or you don't get, you know, like you show up and it's just kids that want to hear heavy music and go off a little bit, and like they've maybe never heard anything like you, and you could be that first. You could be that Fugazi or whatever, you know, and like,
exactly.
There's something about that where it's like you show up and no one is just standing there with their arms folded or whatever. Like people are ready to go off and have fun, and they're ready to like hear something, no matter what it is, you know. Like
the first big tour I ever went on, I was 16 or 17 in my screamo band in high school, and we played a lot because I think it was almost like naivety that pushed us to booking in a super strange way. Like we were using Do DIY and just emailing people, you know? Mm-hmm. And so we didn't really have the same level of like screamo connections that I might exert now to get on screamo gigs. So we were playing a lot of very strange, like small town in North Carolina that like no one has that you know has ever been to.
Yeah.
And playing to people that are just like, wow, I can't believe a band is here. You guys are the coolest thing on earth. And I'm like, we weren't very good. So
right.
Hopefully we're still not the coolest thing on earth to you. But there's something really both satisfying and very interesting. It tells you a lot about the wider culture, the wider country as a whole that we do live in, unfortunately. But like, yeah, there's something just immensely satisfying about playing in small towns.
And that was my conversation with Ben Krako. Thank you so much, Ben, for taking the time to chat with me. Definitely go check out Depiction of Man's demo, Blade Demise, on Bandcamp now. Thanks also to all of y'all listening wherever you are now. Make sure you tune in next week for our 200th episode special with guest host Elias Amini. We had such a great time chatting, I can't wait for y'all to hear it. Until then, take care and do good things.